Chapter 8. On Circuit. The time was approaching when Fiona would be on circuit, visiting cities in the north of England with another judge to hear cases, so that the families involved did not have to travel the long distance to London. She would stay in special lodgings, huge beautiful townhouses, where wines of great quality were kept and food was made for her by excellent cooks. The bedrooms were grander than her own at home, and the beds wider. In previous times, as a happily married woman, she had enjoyed escaping to the guilty pleasure of such an unshared accommodation. Now, she was desperate to leave the silent conflict at home, and her first stop was her favourite English city. One morning in early September, a week before she began her journey, she received a second letter. No address, only her name. This time, she was more worried, even before she opened it, for the blue envelope had been pushed under their apartment door. It was easy enough for Adam Henry to wait outside the courts of justice and follow her home at a distance. Jack had already left for work. She sat down at the breakfast table. "My lady, I don't even know what I wrote because I didn't keep a copy, but it's okay that you didn't reply. I still need to talk to you. Here's my news. Big arguments with my parents, great to be back at school, feeling better, feeling happy and then sad and then happy again. Sometimes the idea of having a stranger's blood inside me makes me sick. Sometimes I keep thinking that transfusion is wrong, but I don't care anymore. I've got so many questions for you, but I'm not sure that you remember me. You must have had many cases since me. I feel jealous. I wanted to come and talk to you in the street, but I couldn't do it because I'm not brave. I thought you might not recognise me. You haven't got to reply to this one either, which means I wish you would. Please don't worry, I'm not going to chase you around all the time and become obsessed or anything like that. I just feel the top of my head has exploded. All kinds of things are coming out. Yours sincerely, Adam Henry." Immediately, she emailed Marina Green to ask if she could find time to visit the boy and report back. By the end of the day, she had a reply. Marina had met Adam that afternoon at his school. He had gained weight, there was colour in his cheeks. He was doing extra work for his exams before Christmas. He was full of joy and fun. There was some trouble at home, mostly because of religious differences, but she thought that there was nothing unusual about that. Separately, his teachers told her that Adam had done well in his time after hospital to catch up with his schoolwork. Feeling better, Fiona decided against writing to him. A week later, on the morning that she was leaving for the northeast of England, a tiny thing happened between her and Jack, which told her a lot. Fiona thought about it as the train pulled out of London. She had come into the kitchen to find Jack using the coffee machine. He liked his coffee very strong, as did she. Her suitcase was in the hall, and she was putting the last of her papers together. He poured some milk into his coffee, turned and raised the cup a little, and their eyes met quickly. Then he put it down on the table, pushing it towards her. This might not have meant much normally, because they were always very polite as they silently moved around each other, as if they were competing for a prize. But there are ways of putting down a cup on a table, and there are ways of accepting it. She took it, and lifting it to her mouth, swallowed a little. And then she remained there. A few seconds passed, and this seemed as far as they were prepared to go. It was as if the moment contained too much for them, and to try more would have damaged them. He turned to make another cup for himself, and she slowly moved towards the bedroom to get a scarf. By the early afternoon, she was in Newcastle and being driven to the law courts on the riverside. Nigel Pawling was waiting for her by the judge's entrance, and he led her to her room. Then they went through the cases listed for the days ahead. It was not until 4 that she was free to leave. There was rain in the air as she told her driver to wait while she went for a walk by the river. She liked this city with its huge metal bridge, a city which had been built on industry but was now full of fashionable cafes and bars. She had come here several times as a teenager when her mother was ill to stay with her cousins. Their house was busy and a bit crazy, a big change from the clean, organised calm of her mother's house. Her uncle Fred, a dentist, was the wealthiest man she had ever known. Aunt Simone taught French at a school. Her cousins were a bit wild and liked to take her out in the evenings on adventures, which included drinking beer and wine and meeting musicians with long hair. Her parents would have been very worried to know what she was doing there. She went to clubs and had taken her first lover, Keith, who sang in a band. Along with her cousins, she worked as a roadie, carrying drums and guitars around for the band. If she had been able to stay longer, she might have married Keith and become a singer. But her uncle Fred moved south when she was 18, and her relationship with Keith ended in tears and some love poems, which she didn't send. This wild period in her life, which was full of excitement and risk, was something that she would never experience again, and she always thought of it when she thought of Newcastle. She could never have lived like that in London, where she was following her career in the law. She had been to the Northeast many times since, 4 on circuit, and she was always excited to step off the train at Newcastle Central Station. She loved to stand there and smell the fresher air, see the city's beautiful buildings, and remember seeing her uncle and cousins waiting there for her. It always made her think of the possibility of another life unlived, even as her 60th birthday approached. A large car took her through a park to her lodgings. Ledman Hall was a beautiful, very grand old white building with 12 bedrooms. 9 servants worked there, looking after the 2 High Court judges who would be there on circuit. Pauling was waiting with the butler by the main door. They led her to her room on the first floor. It was at the front of the house, with 3 tall windows which looked out over the trees and lake. Her bathroom was along a corridor. The storm arrived as she returned from her bath. She stood at the centre window with a towel around her and watched the trees bend in the rain and wind. Then she turned on the lights and began to dress. She was already 10 minutes late for drinks in the drawing room. 4 men, wearing dark suits and holding glasses, stopped talking and rose from their armchairs as she entered. A waiter in a stiff white jacket mixed her drink, while her colleague, Caradoc Ball, who was doing the criminal list, introduced her to the others. They were all connected to Ball in some way. She had not invited guests for the first evening. They talked about the violent weather, and all the while she was wondering why the waiter was taking so long. Finally, he brought her drink, and a minute later the butler appeared and told the group that dinner was ready. The 4 men finished their drinks and followed Fiona from the drawing room through to the dining room. The table, which could have seated 30 guests, had 5 lonely dining places made ready at its far end. The dining room was at the north of the house, where the wind blew and the windows shook. The air was cold and damp. The butler explained that the fire could not be lit, but he could bring a small heater for them. The 5 of them chatted while white wine was poured into their glasses and cold fish and toast was put before them. One of the men, Charlie, who was a professor who worked for the government, asked about Fiona's work, and she told him about the case that she would hear the next day. A local authority wanted to take 2 children, a boy of 2 and a girl of 4, into care. The mother drank too much and took drugs. She was no longer able to look after herself or her children. The father, after not being around for most of the children's lives, had now appeared with his new girlfriend and decided that they could do the caring. A social worker would give evidence in court tomorrow about his ability to be a parent. The mother's parents loved the children and wanted to have them, but had no rights. There had been terrible arguments between the three groups. There were, she said, many more cases like it listed for the week. Charlie put his hand to his head and closed his eyes. If he had to make a decision like that, he said, he'd be up all night thinking about it. Caradoc Ball, who was an old school friend of Charlie's, said, "I hope you realise just how well-known a judge you are talking to. I'm sure you all remember the conjoined twins case." Everyone did, and as the plates were cleared, they were asking her questions about that famous case when there came the sound of loud voices in the hall outside. Then Pauling and the butler came in and approached her. Pauling, after apologising to the four men, leaned over and whispered in her ear,
"My lady, I'm sorry, but there's a problem which needs your immediate attention."
She nodded and stood up. "Excuse me, gentlemen." They all rose and she walked with the two men across the room. When she was outside, she said to the butler,
"We're still waiting for that heater."
"I'll fetch it now."
There was something sharp in the way he said it, and she turned to look at her clerk with surprise. But Pauling simply said,
"It's this way."
She followed him across the hall and into a huge, dark library. Pauling said,
"It's that Jehovah's Witness boy, Adam Henry. Do you remember, from the transfusion case? He seems to have followed you here. He's been walking through the rain and is wet through. They wanted to send him away, but I thought you should know first."
"Where is he now?" asked Fiona.
"He's in the kitchen."
"Better bring him in, then."